Good afternoon. I'm Charles Keckler on the Board of Directors of the Legal Services Corporation, and I also have the honor to serve as Chairman of the Operations and Regulations Committee, in whose jurisdiction the recommendations of the Pro Bono Task Force regarding Legal Services Corporation's regulations have now fallen. The committee decided in pursuing the recommendations to convene this rulemaking workshop and the one subsequent to it as part of an effort to involve multiple stakeholders, including former members of the Pro Bono Task Force and other interested parties, in developing changes to this important rule. The it's a, to some extent, a procedural reflection of the nature of our private attorney involvement, which by its nature involves members of the profession outside of our grantees. And so we thought it was particularly appropriate to have a procedural way to incorporate that input. This is a tool that has been available to the corporation for some time, but it has been quite a while since anybody has used it. Has anybody here participated in a prior rulemaking for us? I see a nod back there. Any input that you might have on how today goes, I'd be very happy to receive, in part to know to what extent the committee should use this tool in the future, and for the more immediate purpose of organizing the rulemaking workshop that will be coming up in September as a follow-on to this. The a couple of other notes about the rulemaking workshop. By its nature, it involves members of the board, and in this case, it's attached directly to our board meeting. But, of course, you should realize that we're at a very early stage of our regulatory development here, and so the members of the committee or the board, you might find them to be circumspect with regard to whether they think, yes, that's a fantastic idea. Oh, sure, that's where we're going to go. You know, we're here to listen, we're here to contribute, and to encourage comments to come in. And so, please excuse our circumspection if you notice it. I also should note that sometimes board members, this is the end of our quarterly board meeting, and many of the board members will have to depart during the course of the rulemaking workshop. They're here as long as they can. If they leave, it's certainly not a commentary on the workshop as a whole or upon the person who last spoke before they had to leave. The other thing that I will say before we begin is that when we receive the recommendation of the Pro Bono Task Force and when we receive the thoughts that you're going to help offer today, there's going to be a variety of considerations that go into how we ultimately handle this. From a personal perspective, I hope that in addition to the thoughts and questions that the corporation has offered in its Federal Register notice and that have brought us together today, that that we all think about the broader purposes of private attorney involvement as we develop changes to the rule. And there are a lot of good reasons to involve private attorneys in the work of the grantees. So the three that I'm going to offer are not exclusive. They're just the ones that I thought about and really find valuable. First, our private attorney involvement leverages the resources that the corporation can bring to our grantees and expands the reach of what our grantees can do. It's an important multiplier of tax dollars. Secondly, it brings in expertise that our grantees have developed, incredible expertise in many areas, but they can't have expertise in all of the cases that people can have. Private attorneys are an invaluable resource for that. And finally, and you know, somewhat more qualitatively, I've found that the involvement of private volunteers in service organizations like our grantees is critical to building community and integrating that grantee into, in this case, the broader profession, making it a pillar and an institution within that community. And so building those networks, building those relationships is something that I think the rule does and that I hope it will continue to do, and that I hope that the changes that we ultimately put forward help to strengthen. So with that, I will simply say thank you for coming, and thank you for everybody else who's participating in this webinar. The webinar itself is something that is, to some extent, there's components of it that are technologically unprecedented for LSC. So thank you very much to the technical staff that is doing this, not only with a new system, but doing it at a remote location far from LSC. So welcome to you in the room, and welcome to everybody on the web to the first of our two rulemaking workshops. I will now turn over for introductions to the distinguished president of the Legal Services Corporation, Mr. James Sandman.
Thank you, Charles. I'm Jim Sandman. I'm president of the Legal Services Corporation. I'll be serving as moderator for the workshop this afternoon. For those who are participating by phone or on the webinar, I'd like to recognize those members of LSC's board who are currently present in the room. We have our board chair, John Levy, and board members Vic Maddox, Julie Riskin, Lori Mikva, Harry Carell, Sharon Brown, Gloria Valencia Weber, in addition to Charles Keckler, and Father Pius Petrick is in the back of the room waving. Thank you, Father. The topics and related items for discussion today were published in the Federal Register on May 10th, 2013. They're also available on a special page on LSE's website. The workshop this afternoon will be divided into four sessions. We will have 45 minutes for each to address the three topics that have been identified in the published notice. And in addition, we will reserve 30 minutes at the end for discussion about what the agenda should be for our second workshop on September 17th, 2013. Each session will begin with 30 minutes for panelist presentations. We have six panelists whom I'll introduce in a moment. On any one of the three topics, only five of the six panelists have asked to speak. So we will split the 30 minutes up among five people. That gives each of you 6 minutes. We will need to enforce the time limits because one of the purposes of this workshop is to stimulate discussion, not only among yourselves, but with members of the public who are participating here in person or on the webinar or by telephone. The workshop is limited to discussion of the topics and related issues that have been identified. Other aspects of the PAI rule and other LSC requirements and restrictions may be addressed as they relate to those topics. The panelists should assume that the board members are familiar with the materials that have been posted on the website and with the submissions that each of the panelists made. There will, in each of the four sessions today, be an opportunity for public comment following the panelist presentations. Comments should be brief. We ask that they be no more than 2 minutes each. We will take live comments first here in Denver, and will then allow webinar participants to offer their comments as well. If you would like to make oral comments as a webinar participant, please click Raise My Hand on your computer screen and wait for me to recognize you. If you'd like to submit typed comments, put them in the questions box on the webinar page, and I will read them, time permitting. We will be keeping a record of all comments that are submitted. We may receive typed comments that are made through the webinar format that we don't have an opportunity to address or acknowledge today, but they will be part of the record and will be considered. We do not expect LSC board members or staff to be making presentations or to be participating, except that board members may ask questions of the panelists. I'd remind the panelists and those in the live audience and participating by webinar that this workshop isn't intended to develop specific regulatory language, although the discussions may involve identifying areas for clarification of or changes to the PAI regulation. I'd now like to recognize our six panelists and thank them for participating. Sylvia Argueta is here in her capacity as Chair of the Regulations and Policies Committee of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. She is also Executive Director of the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. Steve Gottlieb is Executive Director of the Atlanta Legal Aid Society. Judge Mary Catherine Huffman is a general division judge in the Court of Common Pleas in Dayton, Ohio. She is also immediate past president of the Greater Dayton Volunteer Lawyers Project and continues to serve on its board of trustees. Kenneth Pinocchi is executive director of Legal Services of Northern Michigan. Joan Kleinberg is the director of strategic initiatives and private bar involvement at the Northwest Justice Project in the state of Washington. And Lisa Wood is chair of the American Bar Association's Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defendants. She's also a partner and chair of the Legal Litigation Department at Foley Hoag in Boston. With that, we'll begin with our first topic. And I would ask Sylvia if she would like to lead off. 6 minutes, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. To all the members of the board, thank you for the invitation to be here and provide comments on behalf of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. As the Pro Bono Task Force report accurately states, pro bono plays a vital role in providing legal services to those who cannot afford attorneys. They work in conjunction with legal aid organizations in order to maximize our resources. As you well know, the legal aid community has been hard hit with funding reductions from many entities. These funding reductions necessitate for us to be creative, innovative, and to find new resources for clients to have the adequate representation that they need in order to live the lives that they are meant to have. As such, the NLADA has reviewed the proposed recommendations, and we are very happy to see that these recommendations would open doors and new avenues for legal aid programs to continue the vital work that they do with private attorneys, and it would have the effect of ensuring that private attorneys continue to be the vital resource that many programs throughout the nation are currently working with. It would expand the resources that we need at this particular moment in time. To address the first topic that was received regarding the supervision and training of students, law graduates, paralegals, and attorneys who have yet not been admitted. We are very encouraged to see that there is a movement to expand the ability to count the supervision and training of these individuals to our programs. Many of us already work with those programs, with those individuals. We would be able to show to our funders, to our supporters, that we have engaged in some very creative advocacy with those students, with those attorneys who have not yet passed the bar, but who have come to work with us. A specific example that I give you are the new and creative ways that law schools are using fellows. They create 3 to 4 month fellowships for young people to come and work in legal aid programs and to provide legal services that are needed in very creative programs. They sometimes create new, innovative work that the young person will do for 4 months and we are not allowed at this time to count that time. We're not allowed to show what a creative way for the law school to work in conjunction with the legal aid program. We also have many new soon-to-be-admitted attorneys who want to work with us, who want to gain some experience, whose heart is in the right place in terms of ensuring that there's equal access for folks who are low-income, but they have the ability, we don't have the ability to report the terrific work that they do, so that not only we can show that we are helping more clients, but so that LSC can actually show that we are maximizing resources at so many different levels. It's not just about having the pro bono attorneys, whom I will speak about in a second, but also maximizing the resources and the assistance that other members of the community are providing and happily willing to work with us in providing legal services. Attorneys are vital to our work, but so are the students who we train, the volunteers that we train. We currently do this work. It is not work that would be new to us, but we would be able to report on it. We would be able to show you how we maximize what we get from individuals who volunteer their services to us. It would be a win-win for the LSC. It would be a win-win for the programs. This would encourage us to also have creative solutions to some problems. Right now, veterans issues are huge throughout the nation, and many of the students that come to work for us want to work in our veterans programs. They want to expand what veterans work means by including domestic violence issues that veterans are working on, are being affected by. They want to expand some of the employment issues that they have. They have great ideas, and we should be able to report on these and maximize the fact that they are coming to us with incredibly innovative programs to help us work with new populations that continue to arrive at our doorsteps. As to topic number two, very important in terms of the
Sylvia, we're going to proceed topic by topic one at a time so that we can have a thorough discussion of each topic separately. So if you're finished with your comments on topic one, we'll then move to Steve. I just would like, for those who are not in the room and are participating by the webinar, to remind people of what issue number one is. It is the pro bono task force recommendation that resources spent supervising and training law students, law graduates, deferred associates, and others should be counted toward grantees' PAI obligations, especially in incubator initiatives. Steve Gottlieb, would you like to address that recommendation?
Thank you for inviting me to participate. What I would like to do for you today is to not talk in the abstract about the theory of why these recommendations would be helpful, because I endorse them, but rather to use our program as a kind of a prism to illustrate how they could be helpful in our context. First of all, a little bit of background. Legal aid in Atlanta has a long history of involvement of private attorneys. And in fact, when the LSC did a program quality visit, they complimented us on having private attorneys who were fully integrated into service delivery. And they described a myriad, as they put it, of programs that we have for that purpose. Examples being our Saturday attorney program, where Saturday lawyers, private lawyers, come into our offices every Saturday and have been doing that for 45 years in a row. Associate fellowship programs. We've had over 50 associate fellows from various law firms, and we're the only program in the country to have one from a corporate legal department. We have law school fellows, the kind of thing that Sylvia mentioned, where law schools pay a stipend to lawyers to work with us, or graduates, they're not lawyers. Also, we have lots of volunteers of folks who are not lawyers yet when they're volunteering. We have retired attorneys who work in our senior hotline. We have non-attorney programs where we have Emory Law students who do intake, where we have a paralegal from Coke that does intake on our Spanish-speaking clients. We have administrators in a large law firm that help the hotline schedule calls. We have firm signature projects for work with cancer, for people who are representing grandchildren, grandparents to adopt grandchildren, eviction defense, unemployment cases. And then we have more traditional kinds of panel programs. Now, I mention these not just to brag, although I'm bragging a little bit, but I'm mentioning them because many of these programs would not be eligible for credit under 1614 as it is now written and now interpreted. Let me say that again. These innovative programs that LSC commended us on are not eligible under 1614 under the current reading of that regulation. Now, I'm not going to get into an argument with my friends in the General Counsel's office about why, although I would if they want me to, but more, I want to talk about it as going forward to make sure that we can figure out a way to give these kinds of innovative programs credit. The first comment is about representing or recognizing the work that programs like ours do for law students and other non-lawyer people. As I noted, we have an ongoing program of associates from law firms. Now, what we do is we use them for things like eviction defense, temporary protective orders, administrative hearings, things you can get them up to speed on pretty quickly and that are a short turnaround. We like to try to get third-year associates, but in fact, we can't always do that. And sometimes law firms send us people who have just gotten out of law school, haven't taken the bar, have not practiced. Or we may get deferred associates. We had 5 deferred associates 2 years ago. Again, these are people who are not, they're out of law school, but they haven't practiced. The point of the matter is, of course, the reading of 1614 does not allow us to get credit for the work we do with these people. Now, you know, it's absurd in a couple of different ways. First of all, folks like that can be almost as valuable as regular lawyers in our program. They can do the kind of cases that I've just talked about. You know, in administrative hearings, you don't even have to be a lawyer. So you can get value out of people like that regardless of whether they're attorneys or not. But more importantly, it's an investment in the future. As Mr. Koeckler just talked about, the third thing he was talking about was integrating legal aid and legal aid programs into the larger community. Well, when we have young lawyers who have just graduated school and they go back to their firms after they've worked with us, that's the integration that we get. That's the institutionalization. Those are the ambassadors that go to law firms and that support legal aid in our work and support work with poor people. And let me add one more thing. Let me address the one other point, and that is the same reasoning that leads to not allowing us to count time with law school students and non-barred lawyers also might lead to not counting time for out-of-state non-lawyers who are not in the same jurisdiction. And I'll tell you, that is a very difficult thing for both the hotline, where we use them extensively, and number two is it really has a residual effect on getting corporate legal departments involved because, as you all may know, many lawyers in corporate legal departments are not members of the bar in the jurisdiction they happen to live. And so if we want to make an inroad into these legal departments, we've got to be more flexible with our ability to count the time that we spend with them. I frankly think we've gotten caught up on our own language, and we've called it private attorney involvement. And we really shouldn't be calling it private attorney involvement because we've gotten caught up in our own rhetoric. And I can talk about that more when I have more time.
Judge Huffman.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity on behalf of the Greater Dayton Volunteer Lawyers Project to be here. Before we started today, I was talking with Mr. Gottlieb, and I said I was rather intimidated, and I would just defer to all of his comments. And after hearing him, I defer to all of them.
Thank you.
in the sense that he really laid the foundation for what I'd like to talk about. I agree completely with his concerns and the things that are of interest to him. And VLP is firmly in favor of the recommendation. Our focus, however, is on the structure of the programs. And I'll give you just a slight amount of background on VLP. VLP is in its 25th year, started by four attorneys in Dayton who saw a need for volunteer legal services to serve as a complement to legal aid. We are a subgrantee of Legal Aid of Western Ohio, but the funds we receive from LSC make up less than 50% of our budget. Instead, the balance of our budget, which is a total huge sum of $240,000 a year, is provided by private donations. We have 850 attorneys who are registered to provide services through the Greater Dayton Volunteer Lawyers Project in a 7-county area. However, despite our commitment to Legal Aid of Western Ohio that we provide service in 7 counties, we typically will provide service in any one of 23 different counties. That is because of our executive director, Helenka Markulowicz. I've only, after knowing her for about 25 years, finally learned to say her last name. Helenka is retiring this year. After 25 years, she's been the sole executive director of VLP. In our efforts to find a new executive director, it's been very clear to us that having a full-time, dedicated professional who is there to serve as the coordinator of volunteer services is extremely important. And while we may be very fortunate at VLP to have a full-time volunteer coordinator in our executive director, we're well aware of the fact that many other programs are forced because of budget issues to rely on whether it's a staff person, a secretary, an attorney with a full caseload, who is also at the same time trying to manage volunteers. And we've been able to provide over $14 million in donated service in the last 25 years because of having a very structured program. That structured program is, as I said, as a result of having that full-time professional pro bono coordinator. If it weren't for that, I don't believe that we would have the culture in Dayton, Ohio that we do have. And that culture is there is an expectation that pro bono service be provided. It's not the exception. It is the norm. It is the expectation. Attorneys who are involved with VLP know that if they have a question, it's going to be answered by Helenka. She will provide whatever service is necessary for them to be able to provide service. Our concern with the proposed changes is that there may be some dilution in the service actually provided. While I agree with Mr. Gottlieb that it's very important that the services of paralegals, law students, et cetera, be counted, but we want to make certain that the programs that they're working in are viable pro bono programs, that they have a structure, they have a full-time pro bono executive, and that they're able to provide the service that is so important. As I said, our focus is that the service be provided. I do want to talk about very briefly one program that we have, and that is we have a large firm program. We're well aware of the fact that larger firm, the associates or the attorneys in larger firms, may not necessarily be able to handle, because of time restraints, specific cases. Therefore, we have developed projects for these attorneys, and I want to talk about one of them in particular. There is a firm in Dayton, Friend, Fries, and Arnold, that is a defense civil litigation firm. Their female attorneys go into the jail every week, and they, along with their paralegals and law students, provide service to women in the jails. It's obviously a short-term arrangement, hopefully, for the people in jail. But it provides very valuable service. We cannot count the service of the paralegals, who are vital to that program, as well as the law students. But the importance of the programs like that is to provide practicing attorneys with an opportunity to mentor law students, to give paralegals an opportunity to provide service, as well as to provide opportunities for those who have not yet passed the bar. That program would not be possible if it were not able to be managed by our full-time pro bono professional. I do want to add one other thing about law schools and law school involvement. The University of Dayton School of Law, they have a very vibrant and active student volunteer lawyers project. What is important about that program is that they have a full-time staff member, faculty member, who works with students, who provides the opportunities for service. So with a law school partner, it is very important that they be invested with a faculty member who coordinates the pro bono service for the students. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Huffman. We'll hear next from Ken Pinocchi.
Threw me a loop, taking me out of order here. I want to thank the task force for their hard work so far, and I do embrace their recommendations. And I also want to thank the organizers of this session for allowing me to use topic one to talk a little bit about obstacles to recruitment of pro bono that were absent from the task force list. Legal Services of Northern Michigan is an exclusively rural program. We have no center, a city center, no urban center anywhere close to us. Our geographic area is large, not as large as Colorado, but it's a 12-hour drive from one end to the other, and it's made up of small communities. We do not have big firms. The normal firm is 2 to 3 people with a lot of single practitioners. For us to get pro bono, we have to be very careful of their needs, and we have to design programs around their needs. And some of the things that weren't considered in the report is we have to avoid having conflicts of interest for these people, because in small communities, in marginal firms, they need all the cases they can get. And if they take a case where it's going to conflict them from a personal injury case or a workers' comp case or whatever, that hurts their business and they're disinclined to do pro bono. They want us to limit their exposure, and normally we think of limiting exposure based on how much time it's going to be on a case. But in rural areas, limiting exposure means limiting the amount that the public knows that they're the free attorney. If they get known as the free attorney, they will not be able to go out to eat. Their office will be inundated by calls. There's no end to the exposure that they have. They also have very little tolerance for record keeping and oversight involvement. They just want to take cases, and they want to do them, and they do a good job. They don't, amazingly, even want recognition. It's amazing. Our board chair has done pro bono for 40 years, and when we put him up for an award to our state bar, it was really hard to document the pro bono because he never told anybody about it. We had to get his partners to come forward and document his pro bono. And they did so by sort of grumbling that, yeah, he takes so much time out of doing pro bono that he doesn't do the other stuff. But he did receive the award, and we're grateful for it. But he is the norm in rural areas. We've had bar efforts dedicated toward trying to get rural attorneys to do pro bono, and they come to the bar meetings, and what they hear is almost a defiant attitude saying, our accounts receivable are our pro bono. And of course, we all know that that's not the issue, but that's what they hear. So what we need is flexibility. I'm very grateful to see flexibility being somewhat of the tone of the task force, and I appreciate it if you consider the obstacles of the rural bar when you consider revising the rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. We'll hear next from Joan Kleinberg. Oh, I'm sorry. Joan had not asked to speak on this subject. Thank you for that, Joan. We'll hear next from Lisa Wood.
Thank you, and thank you very much for allowing me and Sclay to have the opportunity to participate, and we also commend you on this exercise, and I look forward to participating in future such exercises. The ABA Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defendants has spoken forcefully and passionately about the need to expand the PAI rule for some time now, and we're encouraged to see that the pro bono task force was making the same recommendation. So having read the guidelines, I'm not now in my comments going to repeat what the ABA has said in its comment letters over the last several years and in its written comments for this workshop. Instead, what I thought I would do in response to topic one is start by going back to the subject that Charles Keckler brought up at the beginning of asking the question of what is the objective of the PAI rule. And that really is a question for LSC to answer. But if I were answering the question, I can think of four goals of the PAI rule that I think are important to the vibrancy of LSC. Certainly an important goal is to leverage, as you talked about, sir. This is a way to increase the amount of attorney time available to meet the justice gap. It's also an opportunity to achieve your communication mission that we've heard Jim talk about so much over the last year. The more lawyers you have involved in any way in delivering pro bono work to traditional legal services clients, the more we will solve this challenge that we have if most people are just not aware of what it is that LSC grantees do, and they're not aware of the significant challenges that we face in our country on access to justice issues. The PAI rule also gives grantees a great opportunity at development and developing resources from other than the federal government. And I speak to that with experience. I've been on the board of the LSC grantee, the Volunteer Lawyers Project of Boston, for over 26 years now. And some of our most passionate and generous contributors, financial contributors, are our volunteers. And they also are most effective at convincing others to give. So the more people you have handling cases for the local LSC grantee, the more likely they're going to be able to raise money from private funds. And the last objective that I think the PAI program helps is helping with the building community integration point that you made also. This is a way to collaborate with the other stakeholders in the system effectively and be a part of the larger legal community, which I think feeds into all the other goals that we talked about. The other thing I wanted to raise, and being the only big law partner on the panel today, is just two points about the context in which we're looking at this. And we heard a little bit about this from the judges who spoke yesterday. We are really at an extraordinary time of change in the legal profession. All of us who provide legal services, whether to paying clients or to those who aren't able to pay, are having to figure out how to do what we do more efficiently and do it differently, and whatever it is we do, do it with less. And we heard the judges talk about that. No one can afford the current legal system. We are also at a point when the legal education system is under traumatic pressure and criticism and has to change, and we're only beginning to look at that. With that in mind, I think flexibility, which is something that was very much a part of the ABA's comments, is very important because none of us can really predict where we're going to be in the legal world. So I would encourage you to come up with a rule that allows for continuing creativity and innovation because all of us are trying to solve these problems in a very dynamic environment. So with all of that introduction in mind, when looking at topic one, to me, it's critical for LSC grantees to be able to engage law students and incubator programs in the work that they do. This is clearly available talent. These are people that don't have enough to do right now and want to be doing legal work, and so they can help on the leverage point. By doing this, you cultivate long-life advocates for LSC work. I am an example of this. I worked in a legal aid clinic as a second-year law student. And although I've spent my life in large firms, I have been active as a volunteer on legal services issues my entire career, and I attribute it to my experience in the clinic. It is an opportunity to have partnerships with key stakeholders. It's certainly a development opportunity. Students will remember LSC if you help them at the beginning of their career, and they will be contributors lifelong. And it's also an opportunity for the Legal Services Corporation to be part of the solution of the problem that the legal community and law schools are facing of not doing the job they need to do. And I would love to see LSC seen as a creative problem solver to those national debates rather than off to the side.
Thank you, Lisa. The floor is now open for public comment. If there is anyone in the audience here who would like to comment, I would ask him or her to raise his or her hand and come up to a microphone. I don't see anyone volunteering. If anyone on the webinar would like to participate, you may either raise your hand electronically and we will recognize you, or you may type a question in the question box. We have a question from Pat Reiser at CRLA. You may go ahead and speak, Pat. Pat, we're not able to hear you. If you your phone may be on mute. Pat, we're not hearing you. If you're trying to communicate through your computer microphone, it may not be working. There is a telephone number provided that you can phone in on to give us your comments that way. There are no other questions. While Pat is trying to connect, I saw a couple of board members with their hands up. First, Julie Riskin.
Yes, Judge, I was your comments, I just wanted to clarify. You said you were concerned, and it sounds like your concerns were around wanting to make sure that wherever there were, whatever was happening, there were full-time or dedicated pro bono coordinators, and we've heard other places that's best practice. I don't understand the connection to this rule and what you're worried about. And maybe that's just me, but I just didn't understand exactly what you were worried was going to happen if PAI was opened up here.
Our concern is that if resources are spent supervising and training law students, law graduates, deferred associates, and others, and that's counted, we still have to provide the service from attorneys. We still have to have a viable program. And our concern is not just opening up what that 12.5% can be counted towards, but it's making sure that the program is viable before you are counting those dollars towards those programs. It's very important to have those persons involved.
More about the criteria then?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Harry Correll.
Thanks, Jim. I don't have this as a specific question for anybody, but in the course of the comments, I think it would help, certainly help board members and the people participating in this process to understand what the implications are as a practical matter of not being able to record time against this 12.5%. Because to someone a little new to this, it seems like if the work is being done and the money's there to provide the support, the training, the assistance, it's not as compelling, not immediately obviously compelling why how it's accounted for makes a big difference in terms of delivering the services.
Would any of the panel members like to discuss respond to that?
I'm sorry, I did that again. Atlanta Legal Aid more than meets its 12.
Excuse me, Steve, could you identify yourself for the people participating
okay, sure.
by phone?
I'm Steve Gottlieb from Atlanta Legal Aid. Atlanta Legal Aid more than meets its 12.5%. So in some sense, whether the LSC says that certain kinds of activities are covered or not isn't all that amazingly relevant to us. However, we also have to recognize that anytime LSC says that some activity is something that they want to urge people to do and they want to give people credit for it, people follow that lead. So when you start saying that certain things are countable and certain things are not countable, you have a way of pushing people toward things that are countable, which may not be the kind of initiatives that, that you really want people to take. By the way, the second reason to do this, I actually think you ought to talk about, and we maybe talk about, the numbers as well. Not only counting the dollars, but actually counting the numbers of cases. Because I think that actually pushes people in certain directions, too.
Board Member Lori Mikva has a comment.
Thank you. Just whether anyone wants to address, there was stuff in the comments, but I'm not sure anyone here addressed counting the time of paraprofessionals, non-legal people.
I mean, I'll address that in one sense, and that is, again, I agree with Mr. Gottlieb. We more than meet our commitment pursuant to our LSC sub-grant. Without paralegals, I think any practicing attorney would admit, without a paralegal, they can't accomplish what they do. And they are so vital to providing services to our clients. Again, if we can't count those hours, it's not going to make any difference in the amount of service that we provide. We're still going to, VLP, as I'm sure Atlanta Legal Aid, is still going to provide the same service. But that may be very important to some smaller programs that don't have the same resources and the same number of volunteers. They may need more of their budget for some administrative costs that we don't experience. So for a smaller program, that may be vital to meeting their obligations to LSC.
And if I may, also from the law firm perspective, in Los Angeles, where LAFLA, my organization, is located, we see more and more law firms bringing in their paralegals to work with us on the smaller cases under the supervision of their associates, and to the point where you're now seeing law firms giving awards to paralegals at their annual summer events because the paralegals have put in so many hours. That's helpful to the program. I like Steve. We more than meet, and Judge Huffman, we more than meet our requirement. But I think it's an incentive to the firms to have some involvement in pro bono with you, even when they cannot provide you 5 or 10 associates to do that work. They staff it with paraprofessionals who are very motivated, very eager to become involved, and then that cements that relationship with the law firm. They become more vested in you as you bring in not just their associates, but other members of their firm into the mix.
This is Father Pius. Thank you, Jim. This is Father Pius Petrick on the board. There's an ancient scholastic maxim that the order of intention is opposite to the order of execution. For those of you who don't study scholastic philosophy, and I have great pity for you all, what that means is that you come up with your goals first, and then you do in the order of intention, that is, you think of your goal, your end first, and then all the steps that you need to get there. But when you actually do it, you actually have to take the first step first, and then you get to the end last. And I just wanted to thank Lisa for her thoughts as to what is the goal, what is the end of the PAI rule. The PAI rule is not a creation of Congress; it's a creation of the board, and it's about 30 years old now. And I think that kind of thing is helpful. So I would encourage Lisa, if you could, to take what you said, perhaps, and submit it in writing to us as well. And if there are others who have thoughts on what the goal of the PAI rule is and should be, to also consider submitting that. It's not quite on topic, but I think it's relevant to this particular topic, but I think it's overall relevant to what we're doing. And so I would, again, thank you, Lisa, encourage others to do the same.
I believe Pat Reiser may now be on the phone. Pat, if you're there, could you try to speak?
Well, I can speak. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, good. Well, in the meantime, several people made the point that I was going to ask about, and that is using paraprofessionals, because we find that our lawyers are regularly, particularly firm lawyers, are regularly reporting their paralegal hours when we ask them how many hours they have invested in our cases. And sometimes they're up to 50% of the total hours invested.
Thank you.
So it's something that should be captured and capitalized on.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you for your persistence in trying to be heard. We'll take a final comment from Gloria Valencia Weber, and then we'll need to move on to topic two.
Okay. First, thank you for all your insightful comments. And I'd like to address or ask you about the use of law students as a law professor and one who has worked in our own clinics. I'd like to know from you, what is it that makes it, put aside the PAI credit, what makes it easier for you to use law students, and what is it that makes it more of a relationship that you want to pursue, and anything that you can add about what might be obstacles to using law students. And I'd like to leave you with a third item. Have you looked at the ABA rules that are used for accrediting clinical law programs? There are some rules that might help work with you, and that many of the key clinical programs in the very devoted law schools to that have full-time clinics to provide pro bono services, the state court rules have allowed those supervised students to be the attorney in the case, assuming the student meets certain requirements. And in those states, you might find it easier to count that not just as a non-lawyer, and might make it easier for you. But I would like to know what enables or makes it more inviting for you to use law students, and what are the barriers?
I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that question, because I wear a couple of different hats. I also am an adjunct professor at the University of Dayton School of Law. We utilize law students in a variety of different ways. We do not count clinic hours at the law school towards our hours. Instead, we use law students by pairing them up with practicing attorneys, giving them an opportunity to do research, but also on some of the projects, the large firm projects that we do. Law students are involved in those projects. They then have an opportunity to meet practicing attorneys, have mentoring opportunities, and get to know what the practice of law is like. So we use this very viable and vibrant program at the University of Dayton, which is, as I said, the Student Volunteer Lawyers Project, in conjunction with our program, to really help the people that we perceive as our clients. And at VLP, we consider our clients to be the volunteer attorneys. Their clients are those in need of legal services. So they assist our clients in providing a service. I hope that was...
Thank you, Judge Huffman. We'll now move on to topic two. Topic two is the task force recommendation that grantees should be allowed to spend PAI resources to enhance their screening, advice, and referral programs that often attract pro bono volunteers while serving the needs of low-income clients. And I'll ask Sylvia if she will please lead off to address that issue. 6 minutes, please.
Sure. Thank you very much. So this topic to me is about the last item that Mr. Keckler mentioned, building community and building relationships. Because it's in this topic, truly, where programs, if they are able to work with their local pro bono programs, their local bars, they are then able to create long-lasting relationships. The fact that we are programs that can be relied on by, for example, an LA County Bar Association, the Women Lawyers Association, to refer domestic violence TROs to them that they then handle completely is very important and vital to the work that they do and the partnership that we build so that it builds on other programs that will come in the future. And those programs have come in the future for LAFLA. The future is now for us. We've been able to expand our reach with the local bar associations so that they are able to come to us not as experts in various other areas of law because a relationship was created. The community building took place. One area that's been vital for us to see is the development of relationships with minority bar associations. Those associations have traditionally not been looked at in terms of developing relationships with legal aid programs, but they're vital in various urban areas where there are many organizations that exist to provide specific legal services, for example, to Korean speakers. So I'll give you an example of LAFLA. We have a very strong relationship built with the Korean American Bar Association, where they handle many of the domestic violence cases that we have and many of the consumer debt cases that we have. We refer many cases that we can't handle to them. And they are now very glad to take those because they have a relationship and they have an expertise that they can come back to and say if they have a question or a concern. It's not simply passing on a case and forgetting about it. It's knowing that you have a leadership of advocates, of pro bono leaders in the community that come back to you and say, this is an important relationship that we now want to take to a different level. And it's opening the doors to ensuring that you have long and stable programs. In Los Angeles, we are very fortunate that the local bar association, the LA County Bar, is very invested in the domestic violence issues that happen to our client community. And they, through that program, have established a courthouse presence. And with their courthouse presence, we share a courtroom where all of the TROs are heard and literally refer those people who come to us and say, I need an immediate TRO to LACBA so that their barristers can handle that case. It is not just a simple referral. It continues a relationship with them to ensure that they know that they can trust us, that they can work with us. We do some of the screening for them, and off the case goes to them for handling in the broader sense. Those are vital relationships that this recommendation addresses. But one obstacle to that recommendation, frankly, is LSC's Office of Legal Affairs Advisory Opinion 2011-001. That opinion essentially says that the dollar amount of time spent on advice and referral of LSC-eligible applicants cannot be counted toward the PAI obligation. I think that doesn't make sense. It doesn't, if the goal here is to build that community, to enhance resources, this opinion goes exactly contrary to that goal. And it should be reviewed and it should be pulled. It should not, it does not do anything to enhance what the pro bono task force worked for so long to come up with in the various recommendations that it provides. I think that would go a long way in helping programs understand that they can have and should have these relationships with their local bar programs, and it would go a long ways to ensuring that this approach to referral and screening is rejected by LSC. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we continue, I want to note that I received a message from board member Martha Minow, who is also dean of Harvard Law School. She is listening by telephone, but said it's not easy to hear, so I'd ask everyone to try to speak directly into his or her microphone. But she did submit this comment. I am strongly in favor of adjusting the rule to support collaborations with law schools, law students, and pro bono attorneys, and you may quote me as done. Steve Gottlieb.
I'll try to remember my microphone, especially in light of that comment. It seems like you put the judge and I together, and we're going to echo one another on this comment, too, I have a feeling. Let me illustrate exactly what Sylvia was talking about why it is kind of absurd that we're not allowed to count the time we use to support independent pro bono programs. We have a program called the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation, which was started in the idea of it was started in 1968, where lawyers from Atlanta Legal Aid would be in the offices on Saturday and volunteer.